Anthony Park, how's everything going?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, you're in New York, is that right, or somewhere around there?
I'm in New York, right in the city.
Okay, yeah. I've heard so many things about that place. I don't know. Is it getting any better with all the migrants and stuff like that, or is it just sort of whatever?
Well, I've lived here my whole life, so I have the perspective of I've been here through the 70s and through some of the darker years, and it's not that bad yet.
But it's getting worse, I guess. I don't know.
It is worse than the 2000s, yes, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it's hopefully it gets better. But yeah, it does seem like the world is always like kind of changing, especially the last 4 years. But anyway, wanted to talk to you about Bitcoin inheritance. And just so people know, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Sure. I am a professional executor. Well, I'm a probate lawyer, but my bread and butter business is I am a professional executor. And what that means is if you have a family or somebody is drafting their will and they just don't have somebody to do all the legwork or who has the expertise or who has the time to be the executor, that is the person who handles an estate after somebody passes away and sort of ferries the assets and pays the debts and gets everything over to the heirs. If somebody doesn't have somebody to fill that role, they can hire a bank, which is kind of expensive. And lately, banks have been sort of declining a lot of those nominations. Or they hire an attorney or somebody like myself to do that for them. We're talking about folks whose heirs are all overseas or whose heirs are, you know, have young kids or busy careers and just can't do it. That's where I step in and handle helping families, unfortunately, when somebody has passed on.
Mm. And you have some history with Bitcoin, right? Like, because you're obviously this is of interest to you. And I don't know. For me, it's one of those places where there's a clear market need, but not too many people have stepped up. So can you tell us your history with Bitcoin and so on?
Sure. I'll start off by just sort of admitting or disclosing that I'm not technically savvy at all. I'm more of an enthusiast, and I saw an opportunity to help the community in a non-coding or non-developer way. I am very experienced with probate and what happens when somebody passes away. And as soon as I began learning or teaching myself about self-custody, it really just immediately was apparent to me, like, ooh, this is going to be a problem. We need to, as a community, figure out how to deal with this in the short term, and then hopefully there'll be better long-term solutions. And what I've been thinking about most recently is, what is the stopgap? What is that coin inheritance until we have better solutions in the long run?
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's start with just like the entire process of probate, because you did publish like this short book, and I did read it. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's like and what people get wrong? Because I suspect that most of us that do hold Bitcoin, you know, like we haven't thought about it that much, and we have no idea what's normal or what's going to happen or how people handle these things.
So I'll start from the traditional point of view of probate, and then we'll sort of transition that to how it affects Bitcoin. Mm. Most people don't understand that when somebody passes away, there's a whole process for getting that person's assets over to the heirs. It doesn't happen automatically, or it can, but there's some drawbacks to those setups. Somebody needs to come in and collect all the assets, sort of gather them all into one central place. It's usually an estate bank account in the name of this temporary entity called the estate. And then from that account, they need to pay off any creditors, any mortgages, any taxes. And it actually takes a while to figure all that out and make sure those are actually paid properly. And then only when you have that sort of net amount left over, you know, assets minus all the debts and taxes, and this can take months, even years, then you can pay whatever's remaining in the proportions as stated in the will or under default inheritance laws to the heirs. So that's, in a nutshell, the probate process. There's a lot of potential problems and twists and turns within their families fighting, creditors going nuts, things like that. But that's sort of at a high level how probate works.
Okay. Well, so if you're married and say you die, I mean, my impression was always, okay, yeah, like your spouse kind of gets everything, and it's not that big a deal. But I mean, I think what you're suggesting is that it's a little more complicated than that.
Well, in that specific scenario, people are sometimes surprised that if you're married with kids and you know, young children, for example, and you don't have even a will, Most default inheritance laws, it's called intestacy, meaning the inheritance plan that steps up if you don't have one yourself. It gives roughly half to your wife and the other half to your, in some cases, your minor children, which is problematic because minors can't own anything. So that right there in a sort of basic scenario is a potential problem if you don't have any sort of planning in place. Yeah.
Okay. So so it's not so simple. And if you're not married, then what's sort of like the default and how does that work?
There's like a depth chart or a succession plan of who is your next of kin, who's your closest relatives. And those are the folks who will receive. And that often doesn't reflect what you actually want. You know, everyone has their favorite uncle or cousin or what have you, or siblings. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So so there are certain defaults that you get lumped into if you don't have a will. And what are some things that people get wrong about, like drafting a will and, you know, having someone like yourself, like sort of handle it? What are some things that they do that they shouldn't, or what should they be thinking about more rather than, you know, what they end up doing?
Couple of areas where that are problematic is when they choose their executor. Again, that's the person who, over the course of months or if not years, has to run this situation. Many people treat it sort of as a best man or maid of honor situation, like who am I closest to, who's, you know, they don't think about the time involved. Will this person actually be able to do it? They don't think about financial or savvy. Does this person know how to, you know, get a payoff for my mortgage or transfer this deed to my son? You know, those are all things that, again, they just go with who's my best friend or which sibling am I closest with, not necessarily who's best suited for this job. And it is a job. It's a pain. Another area where folks don't plan quite how I would recommend you do is there's a lot of short-term thinking. Or a failure to think in the long term, meaning most people don't update their plans for 5, 10 plus years. I mean, people do it and they're like, phew, cool, I have a plan. And you know, nobody wants to think about this stuff, right? So nobody really keeps them updated. And the example I like to use is just 10 years ago, actually, I think it's like 12 years now, but just 10 years ago, I mean, smartphones didn't really exist, right? And just 10 years ago, I think, how old is Bitcoin now? 13, 14 years?
So 15. Like,
yeah. So my point is that in a blink of an eye, the world can change, and your plan needs to reflect that.
All right. So there's a lot of things that you obviously need to take into account, and it sounds like there's a lot of people make mistakes, especially with thinking about this stuff, because the world can change and so on. So specifically with Bitcoin, I think there is sort of like this desire for most of us Bitcoiners to not have to go through a lawyer or something like that. Can you talk about that a little bit and you know, what's the actual legal reality and how are things going to be once if something bad should happen to you?
So unfortunately, with the tools we have available now, I do think my conclusion has been that you do need a third party of some kind involved to have a plan that is likely or most likely to actually deliver your Bitcoin to your heirs upon your passing. And I don't say that lightly. I'm very sympathetic to the desire of Bitcoiners and the community in general to avoid trusted third parties or any sort of basically having to trust anybody. So I went through all the different things that folks talk about, all the proposed plans or the setups people tout, like, oh, well, I did it this way, so I'm good. And I just see too many flaws with them. Again, given the fact that transferring self-custody has no safety nets whatsoever. Meaning if you had a traditional asset, bank account, brokerage account, stock certificate even, if your plan fails, there are laws or there are ways for those things to eventually transfer to your heirs, even if you have to hire a lawyer or whatever. There is a way for it to happen. But as I think we all know, if you fail to devise a way to deliver custody of your seed or your device or what have you to your heirs, then it's gone. You've donated it back to the rest of the community. Yeah.
Okay. Generally the plans that people make, I've heard this from multiple Bitcoin people, and I've experienced this myself. is that generally what Bitcoiners like to do is create some sort of like a treasure map at the end, something like, okay, you need to go do this, 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 and this, and then you'll have your Bitcoin. And you seem to be pretty sour on this particular kind of setup. So can you tell us about what it's actually like after someone's dead, and like how people actually come behave, and how things like that play out.
So the experience that I can share is I've done probably thousands of probates at this point. So I'm one of those power users. I see how things turn out. I don't just draft wills. That's sort of guessing what'll happen decades from now. I'm the one who does actually execute the will and try to carry things out when somebody's passed away. And what I've seen is that letters of instruction in general are just never up to date. And I'm not even talking about Bitcoin. I'm talking about like the keys to your safe deposit box or the pin to the phone, the person's smartphone. Like, these things are almost never up to date. I mean, yes, of course, some of it is going to be up to date, but it's almost like Murphy's Law. There's always one very important detail that just has not been updated. And, me and the family have spent time trying to find this thing that was supposed to be located somewhere. It's just not there anymore because the person moved it, and they didn't update their letter before they passed away. So that's just the notion that you'll devise a shamir or whatever. You'll shard your seed and hide them in locations in a way that, I wrote it so well, my spouse will find it easily and reconstitute, no problem. It just, to me, that seems unlikely to be kind about it.
Yeah, well, I can kind of sympathize, because as a programmer, it's kind of like writing the code once, not ever testing it, and like trusting that it'll execute properly. There's so many ways in which you can have bugs, especially if the actual heirs don't know what to do, or the executor hasn't ever practiced it. How are you going to make sure that this actually executes properly when you actually do it?
And you bring up a great point, because again, even with legacy assets, these are things that most people are familiar with: bank accounts, brokerage accounts, real estate. Most people have some passing knowledge of how to deal with these assets. Heirs are grieving and stressed and fighting, or there's a lot of drama amongst themselves upon somebody's passing. And even with these very familiar assets, people mess up things all the time, whether it's losing a share certificate or filing an incorrect deed. Basically, it feels like people's IQs drop during probate, not because of anything they've done wrong, but just because it's a very stressful situation, and people make poor decisions during stressful times. Now, if you add on top of that, as you pointed out, this type of custody or technology or procedure that they just never even familiarize themselves with, it's just a recipe for disaster in my forward thinking.
Well, so with something like a brokerage account, what typically happens? Because I suspect that at least for people that have some amount on an exchange or something like that, it'd be similar. So what does that look like as a probate lawyer?
Yeah, exactly right. I'm not advocating keeping your coin on an exchange, but let's just walk through what it would look like, because it is kind of easier in some ways. Whether it's a Gemini or a Coinbase or what have you versus a Fidelity or a Vanguard, the executor or the heirs present to the institution just a set of documents, whether it's a claim form plus an original death certificate plus something called letters testamentary. It's a court certificate that says this person is the executor and has the authority to collect this account. It's called different things in different states, but letters testamentary is pretty common. And once the bureaucrats at that institution have confirmed that all these documents are original and they have them in their file, then they'll release the funds in a check paid to the estate of John Doe to the executor, which, as we talked about before, the executor puts into that estate account, which is a temporary entity from which they'll pay debts, taxes, and so forth. So, yeah, you have somebody to go to, and as long as you have the proper documentation, as long as you can prove who you are, you will have access to either the brokerage account or, in the case of an exchange, the coins. Yeah.
So, and how long does that process take? I think, this is one of those things that, as Bitcoiners, we're like, okay, like dead man switch, right? Like, oh, as soon as I drop that, everyone gets my coins. Almost exactly. What is a typical process? How long does it take?
I do want to come back to the dead man switch, because I was in love with that idea at the beginning until I thought it through. So I do see some problems with that. But the part that I just described, meaning submitting the paperwork and getting the institution to release your brokerage account or your coins, it just really depends. It can be a couple of weeks if you're lucky, or if you get a bureaucrat who has no idea what they're doing, which, you know, we've all dealt with that before, where you have to sort of ask for a supervisor or what have you. It could take months. It just really depends. And then if there's tax issues or a lien or anything like that, there's a lot of twists and turns, but not too long.
Okay, so to collect the money from the brokerage takes maybe a couple weeks to a few months or whatever.
But it's
in the estate account. How long does that take to actually distribute, and what does that look like?
So specifically, that depends on your risk tolerance or what's going on with the estate. If somebody has been audited multiple times, for example, or who had a business that had a lot of ins and outs or a lot of creditors, you want to wait until you sort all that out. But if it's your grandma, apparently she's orange pilled. But if it's your grandma and it's pretty straightforward. If she was just paying collecting Social Security, she didn't have many apparent debts, then you might feel more comfortable distributing immediately, with the risk being that, yes, there might be an unknown creditor or tax that pops up later, and you'll deal with that then, yeah.
Yeah, so there could be like a clawback after a distribution, is that what you're
exactly.
saying?
Exactly, yes.
Oof.
Yeah, ooh, that's what you
generally
make. What
does that look like? That could be really nasty. I mean, this is the exact sort of thing that Bitcoiners want to avoid, no?
I have never seen an heir give back money.
Okay.
even siblings who get along famously, like, I'm not. That money's gone. I spent it. I mean, it doesn't have to be like a malicious thing. It can just be like, I spent my inheritance. What do you want me to do,
Oh, yeah. Wow. So, okay. Yeah. So generally, once it's distributed, it's really gone.
Pretty much.
Okay. All right. So, you have some suggestions on actual for Bitcoiners, people like me and probably a lot of people watching this show. What are the considerations that Bitcoiners should have? Because if you are self-custodying, how do you sort of like send it to your heirs? And what are the different approaches, first of all? And then we can talk about like what your recommendation would be.
Okay, so let's start with the different approaches that you see all over Twitter or Reddit or what have you. We talked about the letters of instruction. I don't love those just because, again, my experience seeing non-Bitcoin letters of instructions is they're just never up to date. And there's always one problem. There's one step that's missing or that's not applicable anymore, and the whole map falls apart. Another one that we just touched on is the dead man switch. And maybe you can help me. Maybe there's a flaw in my thinking. But the dead man switch needs to transmit somewhere, yes? I mean, upon triggering, in my book I talk about two types of dead man switches. One that delivers a secret, which would in this case would be your seed phrase or your passphrase or something along those lines. Or it delivers or it triggers a transaction. It's a send instruction, right, that triggers upon your failure to pull your dead man switch. So in the latter example, the transaction, it has to go to a destination wallet, right? And if you're not confident your heirs can handle self-custody, how are they going to maintain a wallet until well past you've passed away? I mean, is there something wrong with my logic there?
No. Your logic is perfectly correct. And that's one of the big flaws is that you're counting on them to have the same seed when they gave you the address. And right, like they might lose it. It might get compromised. There's all sorts of ways in which
exactly
it could go wrong.
During the course of your lifetime, they may have. Let me just put this in my, iCloud or whatever.
Yeah, and then it goes to an address where some hacker has access or
exactly.
something like that. So that would be one flaw of the sort of like having a transaction ready and it sort of goes through. But the other one, what about sort of like Shamir secret sharing or some sort of like seed phrase transmission, which, I don't know. Like, what's your thought on that as a lawyer?
I assume we're talking about an electronic dead man switch and not, not like that you hire a private eye who will deliver a manila envelope upon your passing. With the electronic version, that means, again, please check my technical understanding here. That means you're typing and uploading your seed phrase or your passphrase somewhere, which isn't that a huge no-no?
Well, if you do something like Shamir, then what you can do is personally deliver shares to each person or something like that on a USB thing. Just keep this. But how do those work? I don't know if anyone does that sort of thing in a probate situation where, hey, here's a lockbox key for my thing. Just keep it around. Do they remember it or do they not? I'm curious about the hit rate of those things, like whether they actually follow the instructions that you give them.
So the closest thing I can think of is safe deposit boxes. Mm-hmm. So there are legal procedures to protect against any sort of shenanigans. When you open a safe deposit box, you usually have a bank employee and two other witnesses, mm-hmm. so that nobody sort of pockets whatever was in the box. Mm-hmm. But then you have the scenario of if what's in the box is a secret that you don't want mm-hmm. people to see, then now you have three people mm-hmm. looking at it. So that's kind of problematic. Uh-huh. But in terms of how do those, step-by-step instructions, how faithfully are they carried out upon somebody's passing, mm-hmm. It goes back to what I said before about the letters of instruction. People don't, most people, us included, mm-hmm. we can't mm-hmm. foresee well enough what circumstances will be like, 5, 10, mm-hmm. 15 years from now. These instructions are usually just out of date and they usually don't work. Again, because something is missing or something just doesn't happen anymore. Something, isn't around anymore.
So with a safe deposit key or something like that, if you leave it with an error, do they often remember to bring it to, the executor meeting or whatever? Or do they I lost it. I don't remember where it is. Gave it to me 5 years ago.
I've only found one safe deposit key in the decades I've been doing this. It's almost always lost. So then you have to pay the bank $400 to drill the lock, which is not a big deal, whatever, if you have a big cord in there. But it's just it's just an example of things going wrong and people not doing what you thought they were going to do.
So most of the time, people don't keep the things that you entrust them with. You've only had one safe deposit box key that someone actually remembered rather than, okay, wow, that's saying something. I would not have thought that, especially if it's a lot of money.
Yeah, so as you can probably tell, my job and what I've seen has bred mm-hmm. a lot of cynicism because I see a lot of things that just go wrong.
And it almost always goes wrong. That's what it sounds like. You were referencing Murphy's Law earlier. There's always a piece missing or something where it takes an extra 6 months to go get the money or something.
And I'm telling, I want to reiterate, this is with legacy assets that most people are familiar with. If you add in the added complexity of self-custody, which almost nobody except us psychopaths understands, it's going to get much, much more difficult.
Okay. And part of it is, I think, something that you alluded to. Nobody keeps the stuff up to date. And, people just sort of do it 10 years ago and then, okay, well, I took care of it 10 years ago. Well, have the instructions been updated? That seems to be a major problem.
Yeah, so again, with legacy assets, you'll see it with, for example, beneficiary designations. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. where you name on your bank account or your life insurance or your brokerage account. Oh, I want to avoid probate or I want to avoid having to write a will, so I'm just going to write mm-hmm. with this claim form or, this beneficiary form who the bank or brokerage should give my funds mm-hmm. to upon my passing. And that, again, the problem is people don't keep them up to date, especially because there's no reminders. It's not like your beneficiaries are listed every month on your statement or an email. Mm-hmm. You just do it and you forget it. So what happens when you have two more kids, but you only have your first two kids on there, which I've seen, alarmingly, where you were dating somebody, you guys almost got married, and that person mm-hmm. is on your account. But then, y'all broke up. Now you're married. Mm-hmm. It's been decades. You're married and you have a mm-hmm. whole different family. Upon passing, that ex-girlfriend gets everything, which, again, we've gone through. Yeah. We try to get her to do the right thing and not accept it, but she took it.
Of course, because somebody didn't update it. So that brings up, an interesting sort of line of thought. What would you do to make sure these things are up to date? How would you sort of remind yourself? Is there maybe a a business here that where, you know, hey, here's what you're actually doing. Are you sure this is what you want, like going forward or something like that? As a lawyer, I'm sure you've seen the bad effects of all this stuff. How can you prevent some of this stuff from happening?
So that thinking right there is a great idea, a sort of a like a NAG service or some kind of a follow-up reminders. But short of that, I'm not even confident that that would get it done, because everyone knows theoretically, if you look at any of the surveys or the thing, everyone knows they're supposed to have a will or an estate plan. Yet 60% or I think 70% of people don't have a will at all. Period. Let alone, although 100% or like some very high percentage of those folks know they should, quote unquote. So reminding somebody that they should do something doesn't necessarily translate into them doing something.
Because they're not really that concerned about their own death in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like an existential dilemma almost. Like, okay, if I don't exist, then what happens to my stuff? Do I really care or something like that? All right, so I want to switch gears just a little bit, like with respect to like how things kind of play out. I know there's a lot of people that like setting up trusts and so on to have some sort of inheritance plan. What's your thought on those and how those play out once somebody dies?
So in most states, the main benefit of a trust versus a will is that a will does go through probate court. And a trust pretty much does not. Kind of depends on the state, but let's just say it doesn't. And the main benefits of that is privacy. Your will is a public document, so anyone upon your passing, I think, who's somebody famous? James Gandolfini, the Sopranos guy. He had a will, not a trust, so anyone can just go to the New Jersey courthouse and pull his will and see who he gave to. And not everybody wants that information out there. It doesn't necessarily say what everyone got, but it'll be percentages at the very least or something along those lines. It doesn't necessarily say I give my Bitcoin or my Apple stock or my Tesla to this person, but it does name the beneficiaries. That could put a target. If you are a known Bitcoiner, for example, and it's pretty much, you know, you have a public persona and you pass away, then any bad actor who pulled your will from the public record could see who your heirs are. And if I'm understanding social engineering and how bad actors work, they now become targets to get fished or what have you, because they know that there's a good chance that they will have inherited from the public Bitcoin persona who has recently passed away. Does that make sense?
Do the trusts actually work? Like, is that something that Bitcoiners should consider in light of kind of like the dangers that you're saying? Like I don't know how much they cost, but if you do get some of these privacy benefits in addition to not having to deal with all the sort of like disasters that you have to deal with on a daily basis, is it worth trying to do something like that?
If privacy is important to you, then I do, yes. A trust is a great step. I mean, trusts are generally an advanced estate planning tool. So if you don't have a will, I mean, you know, I guess baby steps, or if you want to jump right in, that's great too. But yeah, it is generally an advanced thing. Cost-wise, it'll be more. It won't be it won't be, you know, like a standard deviation more. It won't be, you know, a multiple more, but it'll be more in terms of costs. I don't want to quote numbers just because I'm in New York and our numbers are going to be very expensive compared to other parts of the country.
right. But it's going to be more expensive to set up, but it's basically a supercharged, better form of a will because you don't have to go through probate.
Yes, and there are other benefits. You can avoid or at least minimize the risk of a contest, meaning when you have a will, part of the process is notifying anyone who would want to object. You know, kind of like the wedding scene in a movie. If anyone has any objection, raise your hand now or forever hold your peace. With a trust, you don't really have that step, so you can avoid that. And if you have a disgruntled, if you cut somebody out, you know, a trust makes sense then.
Well. So what is that conflict like? If somebody does object, like what, like how long does that take, and how much do people suffer as a result of something like that? I seem to remember like Anna Nicole Smith like was contesting a will for a very long time. Or the other people in that family, or something like that. Like,
yeah.
And she never got the money. Like, she died before any of that got dispersed. So, how, like, is that normal, or is it like that an extraordinary case? What's contesting like?
It takes a long time. Like any litigation in this country, unfortunately, it can drag out for a long time. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a meritorious objection. It's just kind of how it is in this country. Somebody can just file a suit and just hang around until they shake out a settlement, just to, you know, kind of go away money. So if that's at all a concern, or if you just want to avoid that altogether, even if you think your heirs are wonderful people, but you just kind of never know how it'll be 20 years from now, if you want to avoid that risk at all, then yes, a trust will, not 100%, it's not bulletproof, but it'll greatly mitigate the risk of that.
So maybe avoid probate altogether. But then, my understanding of how a trust works is that it's a separate entity that controls all your assets. So what are some of the downsides of having it in a trust?
Yeah, depending on what kind of trust you do, the one we're talking about, or the more common one, is called a revocable living trust. I don't want to bore your listeners with all the legal terms, but...
No. This is exactly what I want to know, because... I want to like avoid some of the disasters that you're talking about.
So yes, like you said, you're setting up a trust that exists during your lifetime. So it is annoying. I'm going to use you an example if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. You'll set up the Jimmy Song Revocable Trust, and you'll have to transfer all your assets into that trust, or at least the assets that you want to avoid probate or anything along those lines. Although best practice is to transfer everything in there, so there's no probate case whatsoever. Because if there is a probate case whatsoever, somebody is notified that you've passed away and will use that as an opportunity to sniff around, including during the discovery process, asking, are there any trusts out there? it is best to avoid probate altogether. So you need to move everything you own, your house, your mortgage, your bank accounts, your brokerage accounts, and any self-custodied assets such as your Bitcoin, such as your art, such as your baseball card collection, what have you, into the name of the trust. The problem is that's number one, that's a pain. Like in New York, we have a lot of real estate in the form of cooperative apartments. It's like a pain in the butt condo. And they won't let you change the name of your title. So right there, one major asset, usually your home is one of your major assets, is not even in the trust. So that's kind of a problem here in New York at least. And another problem is, again, like we said, you know, people don't kind of keep things up to date. You know, most of us don't bank with the same bank for the rest of our lives. Most of us don't have the same brokerage accounts. We roll over our IRAs here and there. There's a good chance that you're going to forget something between now and when you pass away, and several assets will be outside of your trust and will have to go through your will anyway. And then what I just talked about, now you have a probate and people are on sort of notice that this person has passed away. And by the way, is there any trusts that I need to be suing about? It is the faithful execution and carrying this out in a way for the rest of your life in a way that actually accomplishes the privacy and the anti-probate or complete avoidance of probate is not as easy as it sounds.
And you were saying that all your assets go into the trust. How would you do that with self-custody Bitcoin? Do you set up a separate wallet? Like how do you designate self-custody Bitcoin into a trust?
That part is actually one of the easier steps. In some states, California, for example, you sign one document called, I think it's called an affidavit of gift. And it says, by the stroke of this pen, everything I own in the world goes into my trust. So you don't have to go to your banks. You don't have to go to your, you know, change the deed to your house. It all just goes into the trust because of that one piece of paper. Other states, like New York, you have to go to each bank or each real estate, HOA or whatever, and have them document the change of the name to the, in your example, the Jimmy Song Revocable Trust. And for your Bitcoin in a state like New York, you'll sign a deed of gift for this personal asset, that as you would a painting or a baseball card or something along those lines. So that part's actually not that hard.
Okay. So you can just sort of designate it, and then when it's done. But then how does the trust know that, like, how to get at your Bitcoin and stuff? Like,
trick, right? But for both the will and the trust, the transfer of custody, like, what mechanisms have you put into place to make sure that somebody or some persons has are able to reconstitute or reaccess your wallet, wallets,
So that's part of what you have to set up as part of setting up the trust.
That's actually, in many ways, the bigger problem than the legal documentation. If you have no legal documentation at all, you still have the default inheritance laws that will give them roughly half to your spouse and the balance to your kids. But if you have no setup for the transfer of custody of your Bitcoin, there is no, it's gone. So self-custody Bitcoin, yeah. So that, anything, focus on that first.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about everyone's favorite topic, taxes. All right, so how do those play out with a probate, and we know that the inheritance tax is some ridiculous percentage. So how does that all play out, and how should you sort of think about it as somebody that's setting up a will or a trust or whatever?
So there's three areas of taxes where we think about when somebody passes away. First is income tax. We have to clean up your final year, maybe even last 3 years of tax returns to make sure we've caught everything. This is most important for somebody who's sort of trading in and out of Bitcoin, not just buying and holding. But that can be complicated, trying to reconstitute the past year's transactions for somebody who's passed away. And unless they had really good records, that might not be so easy to do. The big one, as you just mentioned, is the death or inheritance taxes. Currently, I think it's a $12 million exemption, so it's not going to apply to a lot of folks, but I guess the hardcore holders, that might be a problem. the good news is, regardless of whether or not you're over or under the $12 million threshold, the IRS does give you all a great benefit called stepped-up basis. I'm not sure if you're...
I think I'm familiar, but why don't you describe it for the audience?
For sure. So capital gains tax on appreciated assets is generally a percentage applied to the difference between what you sell something at less what you bought it for. So if you sell a house for $1 million, but you had bought it for, I'm going to use a number, $200,000, your gain is the difference, $800K. And then the applicable percentage, I think it's 20% for most folks, applies to that $800K gain, right? Not great. So what is 20% of 80? 160K. Not great.
Yeah, 160. Yeah.
When you pass away and you transfer your assets to your heirs, your heirs get what's called stepped up basis. And in the example I just gave before, their basis for your house or your Bitcoin, whatever, is now $1 million, not the $200,000 you bought it for. And that means if they sell it the very next day, they have zero gain and therefore zero capital gains tax. It's one of the few free and easy to get tax benefits the IRS allows, and all you have to do is die.
Fair enough. And what's the third tax? You mentioned income tax, inheritance tax, and you said there was a third one?
A third one actually is not that applicable here. I just kind of rattle off three because I'm used to talking about probate that way. Is a lot of transfer taxes with real estate, and a lot of those local taxes just don't apply to Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, who knows? In five years, we might have something new, right? Like, and, this is the sort of thing that you need to think about. Well, so a lot of what ends up complicating probate seems to be that it's a lot of unanticipated changes. And keeping those up to date seems to be a big problem. I mean, have you ever seen one that went really, really well? Or maybe you're a probate lawyer, so you only get called in when things are bad. But what's an ideal sort of like way for someone that's maybe watching this to handle your death? Where have you been where you're like, okay, you know what, that person did it correctly and everything went to the right people, and it wasn't complicated, and everyone got things on time, and minimize taxes and everything else. Are there any examples of that, and how did they think about it to get to that point?
I think in general, the more flexible and the less specific your plan, the more likely it is to execute well. When you have crazy specific details, like I want this particular CUSIP share of stock to transfer to this specific nephew, that's when things just get hard. The more flexibility you have, both in who gets what, so raw percentages as opposed to very, very specific assets, and how those wishes are carried out, meaning having an executor or trustee who has some discretion to make things happen to the best, that to as closely resemble your wishes as possible, but with some authority to make decision, key decisions along the way. Those plans tend to go smoothly. And of course, you know, having heirs who get along reasonably well, but that's actually really hard to predict. We've seen families that seemed great kind of fall apart when the money got involved. So again,
really?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Like, is it because like you just never know until like the money becomes an issue or something? Or
my amateur psychologist or psychiatrist's point of view is that there's often a lot of feelings and resentments and scores that are held maybe quietly behind a smile during folks' lives that there's a sort of catharsis when somebody passes away. Like, well, time to let these cards out a little bit.
Oh, wow. So it's like bitterness against the person that died or against the other people that might be inheriting?
Could be, you know, mom always favored you, older sister. Like, why are we getting 50-50? Like, this is insane. I never said anything while parents were alive, but I should be getting more considering they helped you so much. But something like that, you know?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. So there's sort of weird conceptions of justice that come out, I guess.
Some of it is actually quite fair, like or at least in my non-family point of view. If somebody was taking care of sick mom for the last 5 years of her life and had to quit her job to do so, I mean, that person probably deserves a bigger share, right? I mean, but then the other folks don't believe so, or the other siblings may not believe so. So everyone has their own point of view, you know?
But you know, it's based on the will of the person that died, so it ends up being and I imagine a lot of that is, well, she wrote the will like 6 years ago and the last 5 years was taken care of by somebody, never updated it or something like that.
Seen that happen for sure.
Okay. Wow, so lots of things to think about. I do feel like we have a good idea for a business, like some sort of nagging thing. Here's your current estate plan in simple enough terms to understand, and you know, do you want to update it or something like that? And you know, given what you said about flexibility, it sounds like, you know, having a good executor and or a competent executor more than anything else. And some sort of percentage split is usually pretty good. That'll hopefully get everything resolved fairly simply without too much. That's what it sounds like. I don't correct me.
Yeah, that's the crux of my proposal for your basic plan that you should just have in place now, even if you're going to replace it as soon as you come up with something better.
All right, so let's talk a little bit now about sort of your proposal for the basic plan. Can you share with our audience what that is?
Okay, so just remember that this is not by any means a perfect plan or an ideal plan, but rather what I think is the best available solution given the tools and the options we have currently. It breaks down to three elements: choosing a professional executor, and I'll list them real quick before explaining the reasons for each. Having a simple do-it-yourself will. And lastly, in terms of custody, having a poor man's multi-sig or a split passphrase and seed word. So the reasons for each is, the reason I propose a professional executor is simply because that's one of the stumbling blocks where people get stuck and just don't do a plan because, should it be my brother? Who am I closer with? And they almost treat it like, you know, who's going to be my best man or my maid of honor? Just choose somebody. When you go with a professional, you have somebody who you know will be able to and will do the job competently. And it just eliminates one more decision, one more piece of friction between you and having any plan. As we discussed, you have to have something because in the absence of a plan, poof, you're donating to the ledger or to the rest of the community. I mean, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. But assuming you don't want to do that. The second element, a do-it-yourself will. Same rationale. Rolling back for one second. do the professional executor now, but you can always level up later. Once you feel confident that your spouse or your adult child or your best friend, once you feel confident you have a better solution, swap it out. None of this is permanent. But my goal here is to have something that you can put into place today with minimal decision making and minimal friction, so that you have some plan as opposed to none. So, okay, jumping back to the do-it-yourself will, same rationale. A lot of people stumble on, how do I find a lawyer? Let me ask all my friends. Let me post on social media. I need a referral. Oh, this guy's expensive. Mm-hmm. Oh, this guy's too far. I still have up on YouTube my walkthrough from one of the conferences where I walk you through how to use a free website called freewill.com to make your own very simple. Granted, you know, it's not, this is not some sort of multi-generational wealth planning document, but a simple will that will work using that free website, freewill.com. Again, minimize friction, just have something, anything in place, at least something that'll work. Yeah. And then lastly, a poor man's multi-sig. So this is the part where I'm probably most out of my depth, just because it's a little, it can be a little technical, and I don't quite, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I fully understand all the security and other trade-offs involved. But from my understanding, this is the best balance of security now, security upon your passing, and your executors being able to successfully take custody upon your passing and not any sooner. Yeah. And what it is you have your seed phrase as well as an added, I think as people call it, the 25th word, or is it 85, I think. I'm not sure how to... You add that extra word on top of your original seed phrase, so you can derive multiple wallets from your main 12 words, right? But you split them up, and you give your heirs, all of your heirs, meaning your successor heirs and whoever would inherit if your primary heirs, you know, did not survive you or, you know, something happened, they all have your seed phrase. I know that's very kind of, wait, what? that probably feels a little nerve-wracking to folks. But again, that only goes to an empty or a dummy wallet. Only by combining that with the passphrase will you have access to the actual stack or hoard or whatever you want to call it. And those go to your executors or successor executors. And the reason you give it to your successor executors and the seed phrase to your successor heirs is to have redundancy, because you don't want to be in a situation where, as we talked about, people don't update their stuff and you know, you've only given your seed phrase to the primary or first in the depth chart heirs, but they've passed away since you've last updated your will. Now, nobody has custody, or nobody has the ability to reconstitute custody. So that's the reason why you do it to, or you deliver those parts to everyone listed in your documents, including all the backups.
Well, so what would that look like? So say like, you know, you leave it to your wife or your spouse, and if the spouse is already dead, then like, does it go like, do you need to leave your passphrase with your children, who would get it next, or what? Like, what does that actually look like?
Sure. So one thing real quick to, before I give an example, is why it's important to have a professional executor, at least in this setup, because you want to have an executor who's distinct and different from your heirs. If your spouse is your heir and she has both the seed phrase and the passphrase, you haven't split custody at all during your lifetime. Maybe you don't have a problem with that, but then you don't have to do all this. You just give your passphrase or your seed words to your spouse. Okay, so to answer your question, so you, for example, using a real basic example, you have your spouse as your main beneficiary if she survives you. But if she doesn't survive you, let's use, say, your adult children, because things get complicated when you have, you know, minor kids. So in that scenario, your wife and kids all have your seed phrase. But your passphrase goes to, let's say, somebody like me or a bank or some entity you've chosen, your CPA, whatever, whoever you've chosen as your professional executor, who has no relationship, personal relationship with your spouse or kids. So there's no, I know people get kind of nervous, like, oh, what if, so let's say you name your best friend as your executor, and very dramatically, he runs off with your wife and they reconstitute your wallet. You know, that's the kind of stuff people worried about, it seems. So, instead, you're having a professional, sort of disinterested, you know, unemotional third party as your executor, and so maybe it'll be your lawyer, and then you know, your CPA as the backup or something like that. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that. But what's the backup executor or successor executor? What does that mean exactly?
Sure. So if your primary executor, same thing as with your heirs, either hasn't survived you, you know, is not alive. Or in some cases, they just don't want the job anymore. Either they're really old, you know, people age mm-hmm. out. These plans, are, like as we talked about, are usually really out of date. Or they've moved, they're out of the country, they're no longer eligible to be an executor. Or, you know, using more random examples, if they've been convicted of a felony, they're not allowed to be an executor, things like that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you have to go get a successor executor then? Like, I'm not even sure how that would work or whatever.
Yeah, you would just name whatever thought process you have in naming your primary executor, same applies mm-hmm. to having a backup involved, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so you just have some redundancy in that regard.
Yes, that's the whole point.
Yeah, the thing that sort of like makes me nervous about mm-hmm. a setup like this is you said before that with a safety deposit box that you've only had one instance where somebody actually had a key, right? And that doesn't bode well for the scenario then that like anyone has the seed phrase or anyone has the 25th word. Well, I mean, maybe the executor, if it's actually a professional, you know, they're maybe a little more responsible. I suspect that would work, but the seed phrase, like, you know, I've seen this happen like with people that are trying to figure this out and, you know, I gave you a Shamir shard 6 years ago. Do you have it? And they're like, no. Like,
what
are you talking about? Like, you know, the piece of paper I gave you, it's like, I have no idea, right? Like, like most people lose stuff. They don't, like, they're not that responsible. So, like, is this really kind of good enough for those scenarios, especially if you know your relatives aren't that into Bitcoin?
I completely agree, and I do believe the level up solution for this is to go with a collaborative custody multi-sig, where you have a professional entity that will have one of the three or two of the five or however you have it set up, necessary keys to get this thing reconstituted, and then in that case, all your executor has to have is one of the multi keys. It's just, you know, I'm trying my. That's a step that a lot of folks are not ready to make, that feel like, oh, that's so serious. I don't know if I'm ready for that. So I'm trying to make the baby step is what I'm proposing. But yes, that is definitely something that you should really look into if you have any sort of significant wealth in your stack. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is the second scenario where you have collaborative custody and say you do it with Unchained and Unchained has one key and your executor has a second key. Now the government can put pressure on those two to take my coin, right? If they decide, hey, like, Bitcoins are now illegal. So, like, I don't know. Can you choose an executor that doesn't reveal? Like, can you make it so that, like, your executor is, like, sealed until your death or something? Or something like that?
So that's a great question. I've thought about that a bit. One benefit of having an attorney or an attorney as one of the key holders is there's at least an argument that the holding of the key is protected by attorney-client privilege. It's kind of a stretch argument, but that's one of those phrases, you know, attorney-client privilege, where if you say it, if you assert it, everyone has to stop and like, okay, let's make sure this is not something that we need to be worried about. And it's at least a hurdle for any governmental entity to have to jump over to get or to pressure or to compel assigning, well, before we even get to assigning, you know, an ex pub, anything, you know? At least you have that.
So maybe that's a good argument for why you should have a lawyer be your executor. Yeah, I get kind of nervous about that, like, especially, like, given the powers that the U.S. government has. Like, they could literally have a FISA warrant which is not public at all. So they could go behind your back and go get all of this stuff and make sure you're not notified about it, which is...
Well, making the plan, let's say you make a will or a trust with your attorney, that's not published anywhere during your lifetime. So unless... Okay. Yeah, so let's say you set up a collaborative custody multi-sig and you draft an estate plan and you name an attorney or an executor as one of the key holders. Let's say that's the setup. Let's use Unchained as an example. That's a fairly well-known player in this space, and let's say the government I don't know, FISA or like, you know, surreptitiously gets access to all their multi-sigs and is poking around. Unless you've named your key in your vault, like Anthony the lawyer at this address, there's no way of knowing who holds that key. The will is not recorded anywhere. Yeah.
Okay. So it is relatively hidden. Okay. So that's good.
I mean, until you pass, and then things become a bit more public because probate does necessarily have to be transparent,
right, so that the heirs know. But while you're alive and they're trying to seize it from you, they would like not easily be able to know who your executor is or something like that.
That's sort of on you. Like how, like for example, one possibility for storing your original will. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of different options, but one option is to file it with the court. And, you know, in this case, you'd probably wouldn't want to do that. No, because then it becomes a sort of quasi-public record. Although some people like that for different reasons. It's easy to find. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about it getting lost. But in this case, you know, understanding the pros and cons, you wouldn't want to file it with the court.
Okay. Yeah. So in that case, you would want to have something that's a lot, if you're just going to have something that this might work and it'll reasonably protect you against sort of like government intrusion and sort of make it so that your heirs can actually get the coin.
Yeah, that's really the prime. That's the most important factor that I'm looking at. The likelihood of success. Everything else, security during your lifetime, security from governmental intrusion. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's all a bit secondary to what I'm trying to craft here, and I'm hoping we can build on top of that and make it even better in those aspects, yeah?
Okay. So you've talked about sort of like the bare minimum and so on. What's your ideal solution? What, like, if you had, like, you know, every, you had 30 core devs at your disposal and they can make you whatever app you want or whatever hardware you want, what would be your ideal solution to something like this?
So I don't know that there's I think it has to be in layers, just the way the legacy estate planning universe has layers. And the first layer we need is a default layer where the user or the soon-to-be decedent doesn't have to do anything, but there is no risk of them absolutely losing their entire stash just because they've passed away and failed to plan at all. As we talked about before, there's you know, the unclaimed fund system, there's password recovery, and all those sorts of things with legacy assets and third-party custodians. If we could put together some, and the coding part, I don't think is difficult. It's more like mapping out how does this work, you know, and thinking out all the different avenues. But some sort of default, whether it's through a time lock or whether or not whether it's through some version of a dead man switch. I mean, it's still the same problem. Where does it go? But something where the user doesn't have to do anything, and either at a protocol level or at a wallet level, it doesn't just disappear if you fail to plan. It goes somewhere, and the where is kind of a big question.
Well, so, if it goes straight to the executor, would that work? Or, I mean, like...
No, because if you think it through, there's so many scenarios where the executor has not survived the decedent, and they haven't updated the address, the destination address. Mm-hmm. It's the same, you know.
So you would have to have like a long-lived secret or something like that.
I mean,
I guess if you had covenants, you can like update that on a regular basis, and I guess you don't even need covenants for that. As long as you're ping to update that on a regular basis, then maybe that could work.
I mean, the legacy solution is that the destination of last resort is the state, is the state of is the government. I know Bitcoiners will hate that, but there needs to be some ultimate destination where if everything else fails, that's where it goes, and people know that's where to look, you know.
Oh, so like after 3 years, like maybe there's like it goes to a government controlled address. It's like, okay, and you need to do something about this. Thing is, like a lot of those keys are compromised, and this is where it gets very tricky. Is, you know, how do you make sure that that doesn't happen or something like that? It's still good when you're dead. I don't know. But I guess some sort of like something using taproots and having multiple paths to redemption and like sort of one of them hitting, maybe that's your best shot. And maybe it's not foolproof, but there's a good chance one of those paths will work or something like that.
I feel like the most interesting idea I've read about recently was, I forget the name of the company, Jack Dorsey's block, the key I think that he's working on. Something about a social key where, you know, you haven't necessarily set up a multi-sig, but people who you know can combine to regain control in some way, if that was where I read about that. But something along those lines. So it's an elegant sounding sort of decentralized recovery solution, but I'm not really even sure how that would work. But
yeah, I'm not sure either. I guess if you know beforehand and you can construct it, then you can make it. But yeah, problem is updating,
like, or even setting it up in the first place.
yeah, it doesn't. So it's a rough problem. I'd love to see more solutions for it. And some way, I guess the biggest thing that I'm getting from this conversation is that you need to update things on a regular basis, which very few people do. And you need some way of like triggering it that doesn't sort of like compromise you know, your ability to access it when you're alive. So it's those are sort of like twin things that are sort of going against each other a little bit. So yeah,
I almost feel like a default, whether it's a time lock or default mechanism where it goes to the state in the absence of a plan is a win-win, because for the Bitcoiners who just hate that idea, it'll motivate you to make your own plan. And for the people who don't care, then they have a safety net. No, great, you know?
perhaps. But instead of the state, maybe there could be like a business where we're going to have this long-lived key and we're going to do right by, the laws of the jurisdiction of this state or something like that. But we know what we're doing, and it's not going to sit there for like 7 years or whatever. I mean, like you think about Mt. Gox and how long it's taken for them to like disperse that. Like,
wow, yeah.
Just kind of seems ridiculous. So maybe something like that could be a reasonable business. But, you know, like it's kind of like all the cryotech or whatever. You have no idea if those companies are going to be alive with the technology, even if it's possible, like exists. Because like it has to be this like long-lived thing. I don't know how you ensure an entity lives long enough. Because even with the state, it's possible that there's a revolution, right? Yeah. Like in your lifetime. And like that's not unreasonable, right? It happens in a lot of jurisdictions.
Or the state goes insolvent, you know, who knows?
Yeah, or they don't have this position anymore, or they eliminated it, whatever. Yeah. It's just like, what do you do then? So, yeah, it's trying to find some permanence in something permanent that in a very changing world, and that's very, you know, in a world that has things changing all the time, it seems like kind of an intractable problem in many ways.
Well, if it's any, if it makes Bitcoiners feel better at all, it's not as though estate planning in legacy assets is all hunky dory and works perfectly. It's problematic there too. So it's just generally problematic.
Yeah, because of this lack of somebody that exists for a long time.
Yeah.
Only there was an entity that has lasted hundreds of years that you can like leave it to or something like that. But and then they could do the right thing. You know, I mean, like entities like the Catholic Church should think about like providing this service, right? Like, because like they'll exist and they have like at least some rules, and if you can get them to agree for some donation or something, that would actually.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, be more reasonable than the state, I would think. But yeah, I don't know. But there aren't that many entities that live that long. So yeah, I don't know.
I hadn't gotten so far as just thinking what will outlive the state. That's an interesting line of thinking.
I think Bitcoin will. That's kind of the problem. We have to have something that lasts longer than Bitcoin. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, it's like the joke where if a bear is chasing you in the woods, you don't have to outrun the bear; you just have to outrun the guy next to you. So yeah. We don't need to solve for the end of Bitcoin. We just have to solve for the end of our lives. And then the next generation will come up with their own solutions or better solutions.
Yeah. And there's good business possible here. Mm. So all you entrepreneurs, figure yeah. something out. Give Anthony a call.
Yes,
where
please.
Can they find you, by the way?
Oh, my website, anthonyspark.com. I'm on Twitter and most of the other areas, but I'm not very active, to be honest.
All right. Sounds good. This was a pleasant conversation. Well, the topic wasn't pleasant, but it was a pleasant conversation. Hopefully all y'all that are thinking about this can really, really get some insight out of it and come up with new solutions.
Yes.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks, Jimmy.
All right. Let's stop.
Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.